The sentiment of the song that we've just sung really does summarize what the ultimate consideration is, that Christ might be glorified. Plenty of other things that we pray for from time to time in regard to how we would like this life to go, and particular blessings that we ask for in the here and now. And we always pray for those things contingent upon the Lord's will. We ask for our heart's desire and then always say, "But thy will be done." But the prayer that Christ would be glorified would be at the end of all of our prayers, would it not? Whether or not any of our temporary requests in this life are granted, ultimately we want only that Christ will be magnified and glorified. And that's what we're trying to emphasize in our lessons this week, as we are trying to challenge our thinking in regard to some of the practical areas where, if we're not very careful, the devil can hinder us in our journey toward God and our discipleship. And these are very practical areas. As I said to you yesterday when I originally came up with these five particular items, I was sitting down thinking, what five practical problems would I wish to go away if I were to be given five wishes to remove five problems? These are the five that I came up with, because I think they are areas where we're sustaining the greatest damage in our lives. We sometimes don't fight on the front where the devil is hurting us the worst. Our attention may be fixed over here, thinking that this is where the devil is hurting us, and so we pitch all of our efforts there. And he's smart enough to realize that if he can keep us distracted fighting over there and then really hit us hard over here without us noticing that threat so much, that he can do great damage. And so with that thought in mind, I'm trying to suggest some areas where we need to perhaps pay more attention to the harm that can come to us if we are not alert and don't have our eyes wide open to these practical ways in which we can be hindered in the Lord's work. We're going to talk tonight about our fascination with fun. This will be a lesson about some of the various ways in which we can, by overemphasizing the pleasures of this life, even the good ones, that we may be distracted from higher priorities and for things that are more important. In 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4, Paul was describing some characteristics that he said would be true in the last days when perilous times would come. And as he described how people would be in those last times, in verse 3 he said they would be unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, and in this last phrase, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. I don't know if the last days that Paul is speaking of here is a specific reference to the days in which we live, but it would be hard to come up with a more descriptive phrase for our age than to say that people are lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. We live in a day when fun is the biggest of all businesses. It's so big that it would be impossible even to estimate how much time and how much money are spent just in our nation alone on all of the various things that you could include under the umbrella of fun. If you include all the various forms of leisure and amusement and play and all of its different forms, we could include the arts, entertainment, recreation, sports, hobbies, crafts, travel, and just all of the things that we would call personal interests, just things that people do because they enjoy doing them. If you put all of that together, we don't have numbers big enough to estimate how big that business is in this country in which we live. We'll have some reference tonight at various points to sports, but I want you to understand that sports is just a slice of this pie. We're talking about a lot of things much bigger than just sports. Sports is just one way that we have fun and that we entertain ourselves. But think for a moment just about how important sports is in our culture. Years ago, there was a survey done in which 100 very gifted amateur athletes were asked this question. If you could take a drug that would guarantee that you'd win an Olympic gold medal, but it would kill you within a year, would you take that drug? And more than half of these young people said yes, they would. They would be willing to die within a year if it meant that they could win an Olympic gold medal. Well, that simply says that that kind of thing is very important to people who would answer that question in the affirmative. The truth is, in our culture, our basic value system often revolves around fun in all of its various forms. And we certainly understand how much impact that has had upon society around us, you know, the world in which we live. But I'm not sure we are fully aware of how much impact the so-called leisure revolution has had upon those of us who are the Lord's people. Those of us who want simply to be genuine Christians in this age. We may not have our eyes wide open to how powerfully the devil can use such an innocent thing as fun to hinder us in the Lord's work. And I want to say right up at the top that I'm not questioning fun or recreation. Nothing inherently wrong with enjoying various aspects of this world. It was God, not the devil, who created pleasure. There was pleasure in the Garden of Eden. It was God's creation. Whatever sinful pleasures there may be in the world, you know, the devil has never really created anything unique. You know, the devil has never done anything but take things that God created and pervert them. And that's the way it is with fun. God created pleasure, enjoyment. Whatever counterfeit pleasures there are in the world that the devil has come up with, those are never anything but cheap counterfeits of some very good thing that God created to be enjoyed within his will. But if we grant that pleasure itself is not evil, well, we need to admit that in our day, a greater proportion of the average Christian's time and money and interest is going to the pursuit of pleasure than was true in our grandparents' generation. For one thing, our grandparents had to work longer hours just to make a bare living. They didn't have as much time for leisure activities as we do, so we've got more opportunity for that. But it cannot be questioned, can it, that we spend more time on fun and recreation and pleasure than our grandparents did? Well, there are no more hours in the day now than there ever were back then. So where is that time coming from? If we're spending more time on that than our grandparents did, where is that time coming from? I'm afraid in too many cases it's coming from time and money and interest that would otherwise be going to the Lord's work. And very often we sacrifice the higher priority of the Lord's work in order to do things that are simply pleasurable, things that we want to do and are unwilling to sacrifice even for the good of our spiritual lives. Is it not a fact that our overemphasis on entertainment and recreation and sports is detracting from our spiritual lives and from our part in the Lord's work? So we're talking tonight not about the fact that fun is wrong. We're talking about our fascination with fun, our near obsession with whether something is pleasurable or not. So what needs to be said about this near obsession that we have with fun? Think with me for just a little bit about the word recreation. You split that into its parts, you could say it recreation. And that, you know, the basic idea of recreation is the recreating of something that had been exhausted. And the idea of that is that God created us such that, you know, we do work, we deplete our resources, we become tired, and then we need to be refreshed. We need to be filled back up, replenished or recreated. And so the essential idea of recreation is the refreshment of something that had been worn out or the refilling of something that had been emptied. And I believe that would have been true even in the Garden of Eden. You know, there was work to be done in the Garden of Eden. A lot of people think that work was only a curse that came as a result of sin, but God told Adam and Eve gave them the garden to work it and to cultivate it and to keep it. So even in a perfect environment, there was work to be done. And it seems to me you know, part of the what would have made the Garden of Eden so perfect is that there would have been a perfect balance between work and refreshment. They would have worked and depleted their energies and so forth. And then there was in the garden a perfect balance of things so that they could be refreshed and things that they would enjoy. Genesis 2, verses 8 and 9 says, "The Lord planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he formed. And out of the ground the Lord God made every tree grow that is pleasant to the sight and good for food." God knew that personal beings created in his image would need things that would give them pleasure and enjoyment. But again, in Eden, all of that would have been in perfect balance. And I've just never doubted that God provided for Adam and Eve's refreshment and for their rejuvenation from work. It's the perfect balance between work and play that gives our joy even right now. If we come anywhere close to having that in balance, then we have a much better life, don't we? I've got a good friend who was telling me a few weeks ago that he had found himself over the last several months just working almost all of the time. His work had required him to be away from home most of the time. And so he said, he went into his supervisor and said, "I'd like to talk with you about work-life balance. It's gotten out of balance in my life." And he's fortunate to have an employer who said, "Well, we need to be concerned about that. Let's look at how we can cut back. We don't want your work here to be out of balance with the rest of your life." Not many of us have employers like that. But balance is a good thing. And so in Eden, whatever enjoyment and pleasure and recreation there would have been, that would have not overtaken their lives. It would have been in proper proportion to the other parts of their life. You know, life needs some rhythm and some balance between its different parts. It's reasonable to me that that's why God created the seasons, so that we could have a healthy alternation between various things that could be refreshing to us. He provided for the round of the seasons, and even the alternation between day and night, and different kinds of weather. So God wants us to be refreshed. He provided for that, and there's provision for that even outside Eden, where you and I live today. So happiness and pleasure and merriment are gifts from God. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 18 says, "Here is what I've seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for that is his heritage." Proverbs 15, Solomon said, "A merry heart makes a cheerful countenance. By sorrow of heart the spirit is broken. All the days of the afflicted are evil, but he who is of a merry heart has a continual feast." And then that one in Proverbs 17, 22, which says, "A merry heart does good like a medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones." So much for what recreation was intended to be. Look at what we have done with this thing that originally would have been of God's making. Anytime we take something that was meant to be a part of life and we exaggerate it and make it more important than it was ever meant to be, we make a serious mistake, don't we? And I think that's what we've done with fun and with pleasure. We've made what was a secondary part of life, we've made that to be the primary focus. In some cases, we make that to be the main emphasis of our whole life, and sometimes we can't see how important mere enjoyment has become to us. Our interest in fun sometimes becomes bigger than our interest in the main business of life. We kind of do with recreation what children would like to do with dessert. They'd like to make it the main course. Let's just make it all about dessert. We make a mistake, don't we? When we take something that's to be secondary or to play a part, and we put that on a pedestal that it was never meant to be. And I think the evidence suggests that that's exactly what has happened with entertainment and recreation and sports in our culture. We've essentially deified those things. And I don't know of anybody that would confess publicly to worshiping recreation, but the evidence is clear that it's that important, if not in our lives, at least in the lives of many people around us. I mean, you think about it. Who are the people that a society pays the most for the work that they do? You know, what people are paid in a society makes some kind of a commentary, doesn't it, on what that society deems as being important. Well, who are paid the highest salaries in our culture? Well, the sports stars and the entertainers are paid far more than anybody else. And I think as I say that, these dates, this information is a little bit out of date. Today, we also pay the makers of our electronic gadgets as much as we pay entertainers and sports stars. But think of what that says about our culture. The amount of money we pay people who do those kinds of work, look at the commentary that that makes upon our values. Paul says in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 8 that bodily exercise profits a little, but godliness is profitable for all things, having the promise of the life that now is and of that which is to come. And anytime we come to love and treat anything, even something of God's creation, we put that in God's place and we begin to worship the creature, the created thing, rather than the creator. What is that? That's idolatry. That's what idolatry is. And so Paul talks in Romans 1, verse 25, about those who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For one thing, we just devote a lot, too much attention to fun and recreation and sports and all of that. However good it may be in a limited supply, I'm afraid many of us just spend too much of our time thinking about that part of life. It becomes a preoccupation, if not an obsession. And we let it infringe on priorities that are much higher on the scale of importance. Think about it. We will make bigger sacrifices. In fact, let me just put it differently. We will endure greater hardships. We will suffer more in order to have fun than we will suffer for anything else. And some of you are saying, what do you mean that we will suffer more? Well, think about it. We will sit out in sub-zero weather to watch a football game, having paid immense amounts of money to be there, freezing to death, suffering in every possible way, but we were having fun. And we wouldn't sit out in sub-freezing weather for anything else, but we will do it in order to be entertained, to be recreated, to do something that we think is enjoyable. To us, if it's enjoyable, we'll enjoy it even if it makes us miserable. You know, which is, says something about how important fun is to us. I lived in Indianapolis, Indiana for 7 years, and before that I'd lived down in Columbus, Indiana, about 40 miles south of there for 5 or 6 years, and so I spent 12 or 13 years in the vicinity of Indianapolis, and I've always been an IndyCar racing fan, and never could go to the Indianapolis 500 because it's run on Sunday, and I have to work on Sundays, and so I've never been able to go to the race, but I always wanted to go to the time trials. Any of you been to the Indy time trials experience? There's a Harden there. I know he has. That's quite an experience for a guy, and not many gals get involved in that, but you get up at like 3 or 4 in the morning, you pack your coolers with all of your soft drinks and your junk food and everything, and you get all your paraphernalia ready, and you drive to Indianapolis, you get to the track about the time the sun is coming up, you stand in line, the gates don't open until 7. Now, this is not the race, this is just time trials on the first Saturday of May. You get there in time to wait before the gate opens at 7. Well, you stand in line for 30 minutes or an hour, and the gate finally opens. So everybody goes into the track and rushes to get one of the 450,000 seats that are in there, like there's not going to be any left, you know. So you got to get a good seat. Nothing's going to happen until 11 o'clock. So you sit there. In the sun, already starting to get sunburned, and you start eating all that junk food and feeling pretty miserable pretty quick. And at 11 o'clock, the cars start going around the track, taking a few practice laps, and then time trials begin. But it only lasts about an hour, because by that time, it's midday, and the track is hot, and the times are not going to be as fast. And so the teams that are trying to qualify pull back and don't do anything until about 5 that afternoon when the track has started to cool down a little bit. So you have another hour or two of time trials, and it's over, at about 6. You trek all the way out there to the parking lot to where your car is. You sit in traffic for an hour trying to get out of the neighborhood, maybe an hour's drive back home. You get home, you come in the house, sunburned, sick at your stomach, dead tired, and the wife says, "Was it fun?" And you say, "Yes." You're miserable, but you've had fun. We wouldn't endure anything like that for any other priority other than doing something that's simply fun. We can go to ridiculous lengths to have fun that we wouldn't go to for anything else. Fun has come to gain too much power over us. We are serving it rather than it serving us in a subordinate role. I'm afraid the character of our entire nation, society, is often influenced too heavily by the entertainment business. It's amazing to me the number of national politicians who anymore have to court the favor of Hollywood and all of the other industries that are in the fun business, because you can't. That is such a huge business. It wields such power in our culture that you almost couldn't be elected to high office without some endorsement from major entertainment and sports figures and all of the people that are involved in the recreation business. We make fun of value, you know, an unquestioned benchmark or criterion by which we measure everything else, as if the ultimate question is this going to be fun? Will we enjoy this? Will this be pleasurable? We've accepted two very false premises. One, that pleasantness is always an unqualified good. If it's pleasant, then it's good. That's all you need to say about it. If it's pleasant, it's good. And the other side of that is equally false, and that is that unpleasantness is always evil. If it's unpleasant, then we don't want anything to do with it. It's inherently evil. Well, neither of those is true among right-thinking people. There are plenty of things that are not pleasant that would have to be pronounced good by somebody who has any kind of a decent value system. I mean, look in the Lord's life. Did he judge things in terms of how pleasant they were? Did he decide what he was going to do in terms of what would be fun? No, he had a much higher priority than that. And the same goes for unpleasantness. Do you just not do anything because it's unpleasant? Your surgeon says, you know, you've got to have radical surgery or you're going to die. Do you say, well, you know, that wouldn't be pleasant, so I don't think I will do that? Well, some of us would go almost that far. We act as if pleasantness was the ultimate criterion. We're not far from adopting hedonism as our national philosophy, the concept that pleasure is the ultimate good, even the highest moral good. And I'm just afraid that in this culture, those of us who are trying to be the Lord's people are in danger sometimes of even measuring what we will do in the Lord's work by the criterion of whether it's going to be pleasant or not, whether we'll enjoy it. And listen to me. The Lord's work can't ever compete successfully with the fun business in this world. Now, this is a fairly large auditorium, but it's not nearly as big as Reliant Stadium. This building won't ever fill up as naturally and as enthusiastically as that stadium will. Something's happening there that was not intended. What's happening here was not intended to compete with what happens there on the level of what is fun and entertaining. And we make a serious mistake, my friends, when we sell out to that philosophy and we start trying to think if we're going to attract people, then we're going to have to attract them the way anything else does. We're going to have to make it fun and enjoyable. The Lord's work was never meant to compete at that level. If we do what needs to be done in the Lord's work and somebody says that's not fun, that's not enjoyable, then what kind of people are we trying to attract anyway? We attract people to what's fun. We'll be disappointed ultimately with the people that have been attracted with that kind of an incentive. But the fact of the matter is, much that needs to be done for higher priorities in the Lord's work will not rate very high on the fun scale. I live in Nashville, Tennessee, of course, Music City. And I'm just telling you, churches in our town right now have become so entertainment crazy. And we obviously, there's a deep talent pool of musicians in Nashville who are eager and willing to get any kind of public exposure and who are only too eager to play, you know, in worship and praise bands in churches. Abundant talent to fill that need. The churches in Nashville have just gone crazy trying to outcompete one another at the level of entertainment. I was talking to a man who worships in a denominational church just the other day, a few weeks ago. He worships with a rather small congregation in the Baptist denomination, and he said, we don't have the in-house talent to produce music at that level, and so he says, we outsource our worship service. We pay a company to come in, and he used the word perform. He said, we pay this company to come in and perform our worship service for us so that it can be state-of-the-art music. He said, if we don't, our people will leave. We can't compete at the level of high entertainment value music without paying an outside firm to come in and do that for us. Well, his premise is that you've got to do that. What church would not do that? You can't let people go someplace else because it's more entertaining. You've got to provide what they want, which is an entertaining worship service. Well, I expect Nashville, Tennessee is not the only place that's going on. It may go on more there because the entertainment business is so big in that city, but that's the trend. My son, who went to school at Purdue University, where when school is in session at the congregation where he worships, they'll have 80 or 90 college students. And the college students very frequently bring friends with them, non-Christian friends with them, to the worship assembly. And Grant said the stock comment that they always get after one of their non-Christian friends has visited the Assembly of the Lord's people in that community is that when they leave, they say, your music just is dull. It doesn't rock. And many of them never come back because they've gotten used to music being entertaining. And many of them may not realize that that's the primary reason why they're coming, but that's it. And they won't go for very long to a place where the so-called worship service, compares unfavorably to entertainment in other areas of their life. But I repeat, we make a serious mistake when we sell out to that and start trying in our feeble little way, without any instruments, to provide an entertaining worship service. Worship wasn't meant to compete on that playing field. And we're doing nothing but being foolish when we try to do that. But it's an indication of how powerful the pull of entertainment is in our culture when it even begins to infect our thinking about what we're going to do when we gather together for worship. Think with me about some of the consequences of this overemphasis upon recreation. This topic ties in to all of the other topics that we'll talk about in this series. For example, the lesson last night on materialism. It seems obvious to me that our fascination with fun is one reason why we have to work overtime and are so deeply in debt and have so little money for the Lord's work. It's not just our children that have to have expensive toys. We adults do too. And that's one reason we have the problem with materialism is because we have to spend so much on our recreation, our entertainment, and our pleasure, travel, and all of that. Proverb writer in chapter 21, verse 17 says, he who loves pleasure will be a poor man. You spend more than you can afford to spend on recreating yourself, then you're going to either have to borrow more to do that and go into debt, or you're going to have to shortchange some other higher priorities in your life. So this ties into the problem of materialism. We won't be talking this week about the lessons in this series on crippled families, but our fascination with fun is one reason why we have many of the problems that we do in our families. When it comes to our spiritual health as families, there's a sense in which many of us are entertaining and recreating our families to death. And I don't have time to talk about it very much tonight, but I'll just say to you very bluntly, parents, your children can tell in a bat of an eye what is most important to you, what you get most excited about, what's a higher priority with you. And if you allow them to miss services of the church for sports activities or other recreational activities that might come along, you are sending a signal to them about what is most important, and you're doing damage to their value system that may not can be undone later on. It will do no good for you to say to them in words, the Lord is the most important thing, if what they see on the practical plane of how our schedule book works and how our checkbook works, what has to sacrifice for what, if they see you sacrificing the Lord's work for recreational activities, however important they may seem to be, that's what tells them what's most important to you. You may be creating a monster that will break your heart later on. A very dear family, who are friends of mine, who have a son who is one of the most gifted college football players playing anywhere in the country this year. He will go to the pros. In all likelihood, will make a ton of money if he doesn't get hurt over the course of his lifetime. He's on the Heisman watch list. Well, this didn't start yesterday. It started when he was in grade school. They could early on see that he was could be a very gifted athlete. And they encouraged that. Spared no expense to take him to football clinics and faraway competitions to encourage him and try to give him every benefit to succeed in that activity. And as he grew older, they emphasized it even more. They were on the front lines cheering him at every game and wanted him to be a starter. And when he became a starter, they wanted him to get a college scholarship and all of those things. They encouraged that in every way they could, all the while saying, well, but the Lord's work is more important. But they were sending all kind of signals with their level of enthusiasm for football about what was really most important. And now, it breaks their heart to think that football is more important to this young man than the Lord is. But he learned it from them. Their well-intentioned effort to encourage him in what could be a very wholesome activity, he saw a level of enthusiasm about that. He saw a level of sacrifice, a level of effort that they would extend for that, that far outdistanced the level of enthusiasm that he saw in terms of sacrifices they would make to take him maybe to a gospel meeting rather than a football clinic. Never saw any of that. And so their words rang pretty hollow when they said, oh, yes, we have all this enthusiasm, we spend all of this time and money on football, but the Lord's most important. Their actions spoke a lot louder than their words. And they've created a monster, I'm afraid. Innocently so, that wasn't what they set out to do. They would have defended their decisions in those early years as good and innocent and harmless. But the young man got the message that football is more important than the Lord. How is it in your family? When two things have to occupy the same slot in your schedule book, here's something that has to do with the Lord's work, and here's something that has to do with fun or recreation or sports or enjoyment, what gives in your family? What will take priority? What would be sacrificed for the other? Parents, your kids find out what's important to you when they see what sacrifices are made and what direction they are made. Sometimes they will be painful sacrifices. I found out sometime after it happened that my son Grant sacrificed his letter in golf his sophomore year in high school in order to be at a very ordinary Wednesday night Bible study. The tournament he would have to play in to get his letter that year was on a Wednesday afternoon, and when he stepped to the tee, he could see that he couldn't play that round and get to Bible study. And so he turned to his coach, not knowing what the reaction would be, turned to his coach and said, Coach, I can't play this afternoon. And it cost him his letter. I didn't make that decision for him. He made that decision on his own. I didn't find out about it until later. And you'd have to know how much Grant loved golf to know what a sacrifice that was. He gave up something that was a costly gift to him on that afternoon. And the coach just exploded. What? You can't play? Is there something special going on at Bible study tonight? No, just Bible study. But coach, that matters more to me than golf. Well, the Lord's work matters more than anything else that you could put in that same time slot. And the more costly the sacrifices are, the more meaningful they will be. The more loudly and clearly we will send the signal to our kids, not just in word, but in deed, when push comes to shove in our schedule books, this is what is first. Fun will not be our ultimate priority. Recreation, entertainment, sports will not make the decisions. Those will serve our interest in their proper place, but they will not be our ultimate priority. Somebody said, in our culture, we work at our play, we play at our worship, and we worship our work. We get it all tangled up, don't we? So our fascination with fun hurts us on the level of our families. It also, as I've said, hurts us in our involvement in the Lord's work. It's also one reason why we have so little time and inclination for personal evangelism, which we'll talk about on Wednesday evening, Lord willing. We don't have time to engage in evangelism because we've got fun to have. We've got recreation to engage in, sports activities to attend to. We don't have time to talk about it tonight, but I'm sure you understand, as I do, that a lot of what passes for fun and recreation in our culture is nothing but pure filth. This is not a lesson about degrading fun and recreation. I hope that we all will take it for granted that that's wrong even in small proportions. Stay away from that completely. But whatever damage we've done to ourselves by entertainment that's immoral in itself, the greater problem is that even when it's good, clean fun, our heart is in it more than it is in the Lord's work. We have a greater enthusiasm for that. We'll make greater sacrifices for that than we will for the Lord's work. It dictates our lives in many cases. And our kids grow up in homes clearly understanding that despite our religious talk, this is what matters the most to us. May we not sometimes be like those in 2 Timothy 3, verse 4, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God? Do we see ourselves when we look in that mirror? And you may say, well, I don't care for football, Brother Henry. This lesson doesn't apply to me. Please understand that any of these illustrations that I'm using are just a small part of the total picture. If you don't like football, we could talk about something else. I was asked to present these lessons down at Southside in Pasadena several years ago, and Oliver Murray happened to be that night. And he came to me before the lesson. He said, Gary, if you so much as mention playing horseshoes, I'm going to get up and walk out on you. That was his sacred cow. Don't. And he was teasing, of course. But you get the point, don't you? If it's not sports, you've got some other enjoyment. It's not enjoyment, you've got some other pleasure. If you live in the United States, you're going to be inundated with messages that fun in all of its forms is the thing that matters the most. Well, what about that? Do we deny it? Our attitude toward fun is remarkably similar to a child's. You know, a child takes it for granted that fun is good and good is fun. That's just about as complicated as life gets. We insist that everything will be fun or we will not participate. We put others on notice. If you're going to hold my attention, you had better do or say something that's entertaining to me or I will have every right just to turn you off. We believe that fun is more important than eating or sleeping, don't we? When Grant, hero of the golf story a minute ago, when he was a little boy, he was in between the first and the second grade. And I was asking him who he hoped that his second grade teacher would be. And he said, oh, Mrs. Mahoney, without a question. And I said, well, Mrs. Mahoney's a great teacher. But why would you want Ms. Mahoney? And he looked at me with that look, you know, that your child gives you the first time it occurs to them that their parent may be developmentally challenged. Dad, her room is closest to the door that you go out from recess. Is there any other consideration? What other teacher would you want except the one that's most conveniently placed to where we go out to have fun? Well, we don't do much better than that, do we? Sometimes in our decision making as adults. We've tried to find ultimate meaning and goodness in something that is only transitory. It was only meant to be a part of life and maybe a small part of life. We've elevated it to the main course and almost put it on a pedestal and started worshiping it. So when we read about the Israelites in Exodus 32 and verse 6, who sat down to eat and drink and they rose up to play, can we help but think of ourselves? You know, there are reputable historians who argue that one factor in the fall of the Roman Empire, as great as it was a weakness that over time had been inbred in the Roman people, produced by an overindulgence in banqueting and entertainment and athletic contests. There's a sense in which the Romans destroyed themselves by their indulgence in pleasure. What seeds are we sowing for the future of our own nation? We may be fiddling on the deck of the Titanic while the ship is going down, entertaining ourselves, all the while ignoring even spiritual concerns that we are not paying attention to. I repeat, God created pleasure. And this is not a lesson against pleasure. It's a plea for us to keep pleasure in balance. He wants us to enjoy the lives that He's given us in the world that He's made. That's the point of Ecclesiastes, or it's a part of the point of Ecclesiastes. But what Ecclesiastes says, interestingly enough, is that you get more out of this life under the sun by paying relatively less attention to it. Less is more. The more you make out of it, the more of a god you make out of it, the emptier it becomes. You only get the real good out of it when you put it over here on the side and pay primary attention to the fearing of God and keeping His commandments. Then you get heaven and the best of this world thrown in. C.S. Lewis said, you aim for heaven, you get heaven and this earth thrown in the bargain. You aim for earth and you lose both. You don't get either. So enjoyment in this world is one of those ironic things that you get serendipitously. You remember that word, serendipity? Something that you find when you're looking for something else. I found a DVD in the refrigerator not too long ago. Serendipitously found something that I wasn't looking for when I went to the refrigerator. I assume I put it in there, but that wasn't what I was looking for. Enjoyment is that way. If you make it your end-all and be-all, that's the primary purpose in life, you're going to find ultimately that it's not even enjoyable, that it won't be satisfying. You'll come up empty. But if you quit paying quite so much attention to whether you're having a good time or not, focus on more important concerns, then you get those important concerns and you find yourself enjoying the journey along the way. Now, things that are nourishing in their proper measure can be deadly if we choke on them. I like steak. But if you stuff steak down your throat so fast that you can't swallow it, you can choke to death on something that in proper measure could be very enjoyable and very nourishing. So what did the Lord say about choking in Luke 8:14? The ones that fell among the thorns are those who, when they have heard, go out and are choked with cares and riches and pleasures of life and bring no fruit to maturity. What I'm saying to you in the lesson tonight is that we are choking on our fun. And it maybe will kill us if we don't cut back in our intake of it. What specific changes would you be prepared to make in your life, in your family's life, to put fun back in balance with other things and spend more time on spiritual priorities? This kind of a lesson would have no value, it would do nobody any good if we just generically said, well, you know, we need to put the Lord first, and we left it go at that. What specific changes would you be prepared to make in your life? And what specific changes would I be prepared to make? To make a difference, to do something differently, and not just carry on business as usual. Well, I don't know what those decisions would need to be in your family, because I don't know the circumstances of your family. But you would be a rare American if there weren't some adjustment that you could make as a result of the lesson tonight. I did preach this lesson one time in Temple Terrace, Florida, and an elderly sister came up to me afterwards, and she said, "Brother Henry," she said, "I've lived over 80 years in this world," and she said, "it was a fine lesson, but it doesn't apply to me." She said, "I'm not having any fun right now." I said, "Well, sister, perhaps you could be excused from having to apply this lesson." She had reached those days in life where we say, "I have no pleasure in them." But most of us are not there yet. So it's a question of balance, isn't it? Let's work on it. Well, the lesson tomorrow night will have to do with a kind of a related topic, and that is our tendency to be too busy for our spiritual good, our overcrowded lifestyles. If we are a nation obsessed with fun, we are also a very frantic nation, spinning our wheels trying to do more than can reasonably be done in one human being's life. And we're doing that to our detriment spiritually. So that will be, Lord willing, our topic for tomorrow evening. Thank you for listening so much. Jeff is certainly right when he said that these kinds of lessons are not easy to present. They're painful for me to hear myself saying these things because I well remember how I originally thought of these as areas where I'm being hurt the most and continue to be. This takes a painful look inside for all of us. But we're not going to make any progress if we don't look honestly into our own hearts. And I appreciate the fact that you have listened as you have to these lessons. But if you're here tonight and we can help you in responding to the Lord's invitation, if you've never become a Christian, everything is prepared tonight for you to put on your Lord in baptism. You'd confess your faith in the hearing of these good, supportive people, repent of your sins, and be baptized into Jesus Christ. That would make this the most important day of your life by far. Begin your life as a child of God in this world. If you are a Christian, but you've wandered away from the Lord and not kept your commitment to Him, we'd love to talk with you about that, encourage you, pray with you, and help you get back to where you need to be in your commitment. We can help you in any way. Won't you come right now while we stand and sing the invitation song?